Alan's bigger. I'll hand you over now.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for dropping in before heading for the pub. And so I hope I'll make this worth your while. I'm going to talk about K-Boot, which is a bootloader based on KEXEC. So, what would you think? Oh no, another bootloader. Don't we have enough of them already? So, indeed, we do have plenty of these, but there are a few things that have been bothering me for quite a while. First of all, bootloaders from Linux are pretty feature poor. If you, say, compare them with the prompts you find in classical Unix workstations or servers, usually there you have much more functionality. You have, for instance, the ability to run hardware diagnostics, network diagnostics, to do some file system repair, and so on. And usually the bootloaders on Linux have been pretty simplistic. So they would just let you load a file, select a few things, maybe give you some very limited possibilities to explore file systems, but not much more. And then there's limitations on the hardware that you can use and the storage arrangements. For instance, bootloaders traditionally had issues if new file systems came out, that they might not be able to support them. Well, some did, others didn't. And likewise for new hardware. Then we have the issue that modern hardware that you use, for instance, for attaching storage, tends to do more and more in software. So you have things like USB, which needs a protocol stack on the host, you have FireWire, you have iSCSI, and so on. Sometimes you're lucky and your firmware supports this. So then your, say, USB attached disk just appears like a regular disk, and you just use your firmware to talk to it. But sometimes you have to implement the stack. For instance, with FireWire, you're pretty much out of luck. And adding new features to your bootloaders is sort of hard. If you take, for example, Lilo, it's written in assembler, so that's not much fun for adding new features. If you look at Grub, then you're a bit better off because it's written in C, but it still has the issue that it brings its own environment. So if you want to add new features to Grub, you basically have to, assuming you use existing code, for instance, a driver, you want to read some new file systems, you have to take this code, adapt it to the environment of Grub, and then maintain it in this environment. And that's not so pretty. The good news is that we can do better now. Now let's look at the issues in a bit more detail. First of all, what I've mentioned is that you have new hardware and firmware. So this means you get new device drivers, and you get new protocols like USB, iSCSI, and so on. All system administrators like to make the life of the bootloader a bit more complicated because they want to use new file systems and sometimes they want to combine services. For instance, if you wanted to boot, say, your kernel over the network, traditionally you would use TFTP, but TFTP has many issues. So a nicer way to do it would be using TCP, and maybe you need to go over a segment that you don't entirely trust. So perhaps then you would add in SSL. And then things get really out of control. Another example would be complicated storage setups. Let's say you have a RAID array, and on top of this you have some logical volume management. Good luck finding a bootloader that can pick files from that kind of thing. A solution is, of course, that you just have another disk or another partition that you keep simple, but that's not really pretty. And last but not least, all the users have their demands. First of all, they like things to be convenient, have a nice menu, don't have to type in cryptic path names, and they also want to have something that is compatible with what they're used to. So in case there's some trouble, in case they need to do more than just select an item from a menu, then they want to have names that they can actually understand. For instance, this is an issue with Grub, which forces you to, first of all, it forces you to select the device on which a file is, and you have to use a syntax which doesn't correspond to what Linux normally uses. And further on, then you have to specify the relative path on the device. Those things may not be entirely intuitive. So it would be nice to avoid this type of issue. And of course the question is, how can we do all this without putting too much work into it? After all, lazy is good. So let's look at a good place for putting features. On this slide here, we have the Linux kernel, and then we have all the architectures that Linux supports. Actually, this is an old slide. You can tell this by the 64-bit architectures missing, well, 64-bit x86 architecture missing, and then since I made this slide, the Titanic came and went again. But in any case, we have plenty of architectures. And each architecture has its own set of bootloaders, which are specific to this architecture, and sometimes specific to certain tasks. Now, if you want to add a new feature to the boot process in general, you could do it at the bootloaders. If this is a feature that has to, well, the addition of this feature has to touch every bootloader, then you're in for a lot of work. I think the last time we did anything at this level was with the introduction of initRD, because back then the world was still sort of small and under control. And, well, this was about 10 years ago. And since then it has become increasingly unattractive to do things at that level. You're a bit better off if you can do things entirely within the architecture part. And there have been changes that have happened on that side. But still, it's a lot of architectures you have to touch, and usually you will only be able to test your changes on a really, really tiny fraction of them, which isn't so great either. Now, on the other side, we have user space. User space enjoys a narrow, pretty stable interface with the kernel. It's an easy, pleasant world. And, of course, you have one kernel and one view that user space has of this. So this is actually the nice side of the system. So if you have to add features, it would be best if you could add them on the user space side. And, of course, this is exactly what kboot is about. The idea is that your Linux system can reach all the places, or almost all the places, where you would actually want to load a kernel or an initRD or other things from. There are very, very few cases where you cannot reach those things. Sometimes if you have some obscure flash that needs some special interface to program, maybe then you can't. But usually you want to put your kernel at a place that you can actually write to from the live system. And obviously on your Linux system, you already have the complete set of recovery tools or file system exploration tools, all this type of stuff. Everything is there. You have well-known user interfaces. People know how to use FSCK, or at least they can look it up on a man page. They don't have to figure out some obscure syntax that you might have introduced for your own tools. And the best thing is, of course, somebody else is taking care of maintaining that. And so this means that the Linux system is the perfect bootloader. So what is missing? Basically, we need two things. We need to have some user interface, basically the bootloader shell, or the menu, whatever you want. And we need to put all the things together. So essentially, we need a mini distribution. And this mini distribution looks like this with kboot. First of all, you have your kernel. Preferably, you pick a lean kernel where you don't configure all of the stuff that you might possibly connect to your machine, which is completely irrelevant to the boot process. I mean, if you want to, you can do this, but it will just make your boot kernel very big, which is an issue if you are constrained for space. Let's say, if you want to put all those things into flash, then you will not have gigabytes of it. So there you want to save a bit. And on top of this, there's the C library. This can be uclibc, which is a small C library. And if you don't care much about space, then very soon you will also be able to use glibc, just integrating some patches that add support for that. And on top of this, you have a bunch of applications. There's BusyBox, which is one program that combines all of the common Unix utilities, like a shell, cat, mount, ls, whatever. And there are a few more specialized ones. There's a small number of programs that are specific to the kboot environment, handling some specific tasks in there. Then there's udev to populate your dev file system. There's dropware, which is an SSH implementation. There's kexec, which actually does the booting. I will go to this in a moment. And you can add other things as you like. And you still need to have some first stage bootloader called a grub or lilo, which brings the system into memory, loads the kernel and your init MFS, which contains all those things. And then your system boots and then it executes the kboot shell, which is currently just a shell script. Now let's look at the boot process. You start with your firmware. Let's see your BIOS. Let me try to use the mouse to point. So you have your firmware, which loads your initial bootloader. This could be something like Grub, Lido, or whatever works on your architecture. Then this one loads the kernel image and the init2mfs for kboot. The kboot kernel boots, mounts init2mfs, mounts the init2mfs, and there you have a small user space, which I call the kboot environment. And then you do whatever you want to do there, usually just hit enter to select your default kernel, or maybe enter some commands, pick the kernel you want to boot, pass some additional options, whatever. And then this one loads the real kernel and possibly an init.d and stuff, and uses kexec to execute this. And then you're in your main system, which I call the booted environment. And yeah, there might also be the possibility to actually go back to the firmware to boot a legacy operating system. Actually, I haven't implemented this yet because it seems to be unlikely that you would want anything but Linux, so I thought I could skip that for a while. So this is how kexec works. This is a combination of a small user space program and a system call in the kernel made by Eric Biedermann. And what it does is that you load a file into memory, just as you do. It's just a normal read operation. And then you set up a descriptor and tell the kexec system call, here are my pages, and I want to have them executed. And what the kexec system call then does is it takes those pages, which are scattered around memory, copies them into the right order, overwriting the kernel that has been running before, and then executes this kernel. Now, unfortunately, things can go wrong. Kexec can fail the main issue is if device drivers don't behave properly. One issue is that the device driver may just not shut down properly, so the device is still doing stuff while you reboot, the new system comes up, and maybe it scribbles all over memory or so. That is ugly. Another possibility is that the device driver expects the device to be in the state into which the firmware initializes it. And if you don't put it into explicitly the state, then after the reboot, it will be confused, the device driver will be confused and not be able to handle the device properly. And last but not least, you might have some devices that you actually cannot reset because it's just some obscure undocumented method, or maybe it can only be done by a hardware reset. And well, the issue is that there are lots of drivers out there and lots of devices, and people haven't used kexec so much yet. I mean, it's getting better with time, but still, kexec is a bit of a rare application. And kboot might well be the first sort of mass market application of kexec. So I would expect people to find bugs when using kboot, because the kexec itself works properly, but just the device drivers don't. And this will take some time for people to report those things, then to find the device driver offers, get them to fix this, and so on. This is an ongoing process. So with time, the situation should improve. So if you try kboot and it doesn't work perfectly, don't despair. Now, what can kboot do for you? Well, one key feature is navigation with auto mounting. You can basically give it a path name, and either you do it in a CD, or you use a file name completion to get where you want, or if you know that the complete path name of a file you want to load, you can just enter the name of the file, let's say the kernel image. And what kboot does is, because it knows your system, it knows your FS tab, it will auto mount directories as it goes through the path, and then give it that thing. So you don't have to do any of the setup work manually. It will only do this on demand, so for instance, if your configuration also includes things on NFS, then you wouldn't get the bootloader to sit there for half an hour trying to mount things from a file server that isn't there, unless you ask it to do this. And you can use other protocols. You can use HTTP, FTP, TFTP, basically everything that WGET supports. You can execute command in the kbut shell. You can execute things that are in the kbut environment. So you're not touching any of the booted system, only the things that came with the init to MFS. Or you can also execute commands from the actual system that you're going to boot. What kboot does then is it does a change root to the root file system of your booted system, because usually you will have a mismatch with the libraries, with the shared libraries, so you must use the real environment. And it can also use the network, it can auto-configure its IP address using DHCP, or you can specify a static address if you prefer. It uses DNS. You have SSH, outbound and inbound, so forget about your terminal servers. And you have all the other small things that you have in bootloaders. You have a timeout, you have a startup message, you can set the root device, specify which init ID you want to use, have a non-default key map, and so on. Now, where does the configuration information come from? Here we have the kboot environment, here we have the booted environment. During installation of kboot, the install process can pick files from your booted environment, let's say your FS tab, your hosts file, or the configuration you've prepared for kboot, and copy this onto the init MFS that will be used by kboot. So this is sort of your fallback configuration that will always be there. And then when kboot comes up, if you let it do this, then it will mount your root file system and get the latest copies of those files and overwrite the ones that came in the init MFS. So this means that kboot will automatically have the latest updates, for instance, of your host's file, or if you add new disks, and as long as you don't change the root file system itself, it will know about them too. If things go wrong, you can also suppress this, then you fall back to the things that have just been put into the init MFS. Now, this is an example session of booting with kboot. First of all, it configures the network with DHCP, then it will mount a root file system to update the configuration files, so it takes FS tab hosts, it gets other things like, for instance, your SSH keys, and then, for instance, you can choose to CD to boot. Let's assume boot is on a separate partition, then it would look in a FS tab and see, oh, boot isn't there yet. But it knows how to mount it, so it mounts it. And then you could say execute a bset image there, and you specify an init ID. Let's say you get your init ID over from a web server. So then it would fire up a wget to download your init ID and put everything together and boot the system. So far, so good. There's still a few things that need to be done. It starts with configuration. The configuration is at the moment admittedly a bit messy because I'm not properly separating the build process and the install process. So this needs to be done a bit better. Also, the configuration is currently just a shell script. It asks you lots of questions. And it would be nice if you have something that allows you to navigate through the questions, go back to previous questions, basically something like menu config. Then it would also be nice to be able to make persistent configuration changes at boot time. For instance, that you could say, I want to boot this kernel, and this should be my default kernel now. And this isn't there yet. I still have to think about a good way for doing this. It's always a bit tricky, this type of stuff, because obviously you don't want to incur the risk of cloudering your file systems at that point. I should also make extensions a bit easier. At the moment, what you do when you want to add something to this init MFS is that you go to the make file of kboot, which is a huge make file which knows how to build all the components in there, and you add a few sections for these components. And it's not too bad to do it, but it would be nice if you could just drop in something and it would be there. This will be simplified if glibc is supported. If you're in an environment where you don't care that much about space, for instance, if you're booting from a hard disk anyway, so you have tons of gigabytes of space there, so if you have, say, 1 megabyte more for just having glibc in your system, that's not really a tragedy. So, and this allows you to just pick any binaries you have living in your system and put this into the init-rd. So this would be a very quick way for moving things into there. A slightly more advanced approaches would be to have some sort of package addition mechanism or converge with an existing distribution designed for small systems like Open Embedded or Rock Linux. But the focus there is on those embedded distributions because they tend to allow you to strip out stuff that you don't need. For instance, you wouldn't want to install man pages or even HTML or PostScript documentation on this init MFS. And yeah, I also need to do some regression tests. There's more work to do. It should support more environments. At the moment, it's basically Intel 386 architecture, Intel 32-bit architecture. However, it already runs on other platforms. The people at IBM in Germany have done quite a bit of work getting it to run on the 390 architecture, which is a completely different class of machines. And this is called, they call it K-Boot SL. And they made quite a number of interesting extensions. Some of them I'm putting back into my K-Boot. It sort of runs on the x86 64 architecture. There are a few bumps in on the road, but a while ago, someone from Intel actually tried to make it work and succeeded. And so there's no big obstacles; it just needs to be smoothed out a bit. And that came a bit of a surprise to me a few weeks ago. I heard that they put the K-Boot on the PlayStation 3, on the Linux that boots on the PlayStation 3. It was a bit surprising because I wouldn't actually have considered it to be ready for sort of to hit real users. It was still more at the proof of concept stage, but they took it anyway. So yeah, now it also runs on the PlayStation 3, which is a power PC. Then the other things, your platforms don't only, the platform issues are not only the architecture, but also how your storage is structured. So you get all those nice things like RAID, LVM, and so on. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you have files that you want to access over SMB. Who knows? And so support for this should also be added. This is something that I would actually rather have somebody else do because I keep my disk simple, and so I don't have RAID, LVM, and all this. So most likely I wouldn't do it in the most logical way, in the most straightforward way, if I add support for this. So contributions are welcome for this part of things. Incidentally, K-Boot SL already has EVMS. This just shows that it's indeed easy to put this type of things into the system. Then I currently don't support kernel modules. Old school, I built monolithic kernels. But yeah, definitely, for instance, it would be nice also if I could now have the wireless access in my K-Boot environment. And so for this I would need, for instance, kernel modules. So kernel modules definitely need to be supported. I still need to do that. Also the putting of legacy operating systems, that's still missing. And something that should also be nice is the ability to actually have multiple routes. Let's say on your system you have, say, a Debian installation, Debian system and the Fedora system and the Gentoo system. Let's say you use this for testing your programs. You have all those different system environments, and each of them is sort of encapsulated. It's completely separate from the others. So when you go to the root of one of them, then you're in a completely different world than in the root of the others. And it would be nice if K-Boot change the root variable, would go to this new file system and dig out the files there, get the FS tab of the other system, for instance, and replace the information that it has had before. So that's also something I still have to do. Gee, there's more. there are obviously two issues with something like K-Boot. One is space. If the space you have for your bootloader is really small, then K-Boot might not be the right solution. At the moment, the init MFS it builds is about 800 kilobytes. This is with everything in there, including SSH. If you don't need the SSH, you can shrink it a bit. But still, if you want to cram everything on a floppy, it gets a bit tight. I did it once, had a system that I could only boot from floppy, and I wanted to use, and I needed to have NFS in there, so I tried to use kboot for it. But it's not a pleasant trip. If you have, say, 2 megs of memory, of storage space, you're already much better off. If you have 4, so you don't care about space anymore. And if you have a disk, even less. And the other thing is time. Obviously, it takes a bit of time for this intermediate kernel, the kboot kernel, to come up. And the most annoying thing in there are the device scans. Let's say you have all your IDE buses and so you start up your machine, the BIOS comes up and says, lots of IDE buses to scan. And it goes and spends quite a while doing that. Eventually, it is happy to have found everything that you already knew was there, that has been there forever. And then comes up the kboot kernel. Well, again, it goes and scans your IDE buses. So you wait a little longer. Then you choose whatever you want to boot. You boot your real system. And guess what? It does another scan of your IDE buses, finding exactly the same information, and so on, for all types of buses. So this is not pretty. Now, what could be done is that you actually tell the kernel what it is supposed to find. Because normally, you don't have to wait till the end of the scan to encounter all the devices that are there. There's just some really silly timeouts that make sure that if you have a disk that's really, really slow to respond and come up, then there will be still time for it to show up in time. But normally, your disks answer almost instantly. And after that, if you know that all the disks that you expect to find are there, then you can already proceed. So an easy solution would be just to pass this information to the kernel. For instance, after the kboot kernel has done its detection, it knows what is there. It can pass this information to the next kernel, telling it you will find 2 disks and a CD-ROM drive. And once this kernel has found those things, it doesn't have to do all the waiting. This would accelerate the device scan of the second kernel. Now you could get a little bit further by actually also reducing the time for the device scan of the first kernel, because if you have this information already and your system doesn't change a lot, particularly as far as the booting is concerned, then you can just pass this information already to the first kernel, as a kernel boot parameter passed by Guavo or Lilo. And then this kernel would also have this information and could also skip the device scan. So that should be pretty nice. And of course, if the kernel detects something that doesn't fit this picture, if a new disk appears, then it could fall back to doing the normal scan. There's a certain risk that you might miss some new devices with this approach, but as long as there's the ability to do a manual override, then you should be fine. And in most cases, you wouldn't want to boot from these devices at that time anyway. There can be some exceptions, like for instance, if you want to boot from a USB stick or so, but hopefully not too many. And there's been some preliminary work by Dipankar from IBM in India. And I'm not quite sure if this has led to something. He has a slightly different angle on those things because he doesn't really want to cut on those aspects, but it goes in the same direction. So this is something that's slowly ongoing, and this will improve boot time. The user interface. The user interface at the moment is pretty ugly. You just get a text prompt, and to make it even more uglier, there are some log messages being spat out by the demons which are running in the background to clutter the interface a bit more. So at the moment, it's not pretty at all. So first of all, I need to get rid of those messages. That should be a big deal, just have to do it. Add some sort of text menu. And then I just saw that the PlayStation 3 people are building some really, really nice graphical user interface for kboot. And I definitely intend to steal that one. And that should also give kboot a nice splash screen and graphical user interface. And then the main part of kboot at the moment is a shell script, which is sort of cool, because my bootloader is a shell. There are some limitations of what you can do. Particularly all the coding gets really nasty, because I always have to build associative arrays and so in the shell. And it's bordering on becoming unmaintainable. And so I need to rewrite all that in C. This will make the kboot code a bit larger. I expect maybe a size increase of perhaps 100K or so in the end. But yeah, it's unavoidable. Oh yes, and I don't want to maintain this forever, so eventually I'd like to find a maintainer. All those people who had the pleasure of using code that I've actually maintained for a while will certainly agree that I'm not a great maintainer. So I also need to find a maintainer at some point. Okay, so I'm already at the end of my talk. So K-Boot is at the moment basically in a proof of concept stage. Or if you are more adventurous, you can also put it in a production system, like the PlayStation 3 people did. And it's not too big. I've once put it on a floppy. It's a bit slow, but there's still a few ways to improve this. But the proof of concept works nicely. And it's pretty easy to do extensions. It could still be made easier, but people have extended it successfully, so it is definitely possible. And the goal is to, first of all, fix all the basic problems, and then actually go out and reap in the flexibility benefits, like, for instance, supporting weight, LVM, all the complicated things that also touch other areas of system administration. And yeah, that's the URL where you can find all the stuff. I can actually show you how a live system, a live use of K-Boot looks like. So first of all, the BIOS comes up. Takes a little while. Eventually it will start Lilo, which then boots the K-Boot kernel. Okay, the kernel does its initialization, fires up user space. Now it's looking for, say, its IP address, which it will not find because there's no network connected. It has also mounted the root file system. These are those asynchronous log messages I was talking about. And then you got it updated the SSH keys from the host file, from the booted environment. And now there's the K-boot prompt. And now I could, for instance, boot a new kernel. Let's try something, just my current development kernel. There's file name completion. Asynchronous messages are really ugly. And then I've hit the kernel. Oops. And here's the bset image. And off we go. And now the new kernel boots, does all its initialization, and so on. Of course, if I just had wanted to boot the default kernel, I would have just hit enter or just waited for the timeout. Okay, we still have time for questions.
Am I wired?
Okay. Questions, please? Yes, please. Okay, I'm getting the mic.
Did you see the K-boot kernel being built specifically, you know, as part of the installation process to start with? For example, for your specific for your specific network drivers, etc.
Okay, what happens is that you provide a kernel configuration file, and then the K-boot build process actually downloads the Linux kernel, and it picks out information from your config file, for instance, to find out if you have networking or if you have NFS, and then configures those capabilities in the K-boot system, and it will also, well, at the moment, it also will build this kernel for you. But actually, I want to get rid of that, because most of the time you will already have a kernel that's good enough, and you may not want to have this done all the time. I mean, you could still have the possibility to build it, but it wouldn't do this by default. But yes, you can build your kernel as part of the K-boot build and install process. Whether this kernel differs a lot from your regular kernel is really up to you. If you want to have it small, then it will kick out all the things that you don't absolutely need in the K-boot environment. If you're lazy, you just keep everything in. And you pay the price that you pay is that everything needs a bit more space. Other questions?
you say that kexec doesn't always work. Are the kind of times when it would fail you, like failure, likely to be mitigated when suspend works with those same drivers?
Yes. It's usually just the type of things when it what causes the kexec process to fail is basically when a device driver doesn't shut down properly when it's asked nicely.
Yeah.
And if all the suspend support and the resume support is done properly, this goes a long way towards achieving this goal.
Thanks.
Other questions?
Yes.
Okay, so then
thank you
very much
for
your attention.
Thank you very much.